Every 26,000 years, Earth lines up with the exact center of the galaxy at 1111, that number I keep seeing. On December 21st, 2012, this event happens again, and the ancient Maya calculated that it would mark the end, not only of this age, but of human consciousness as we know it. In a moment, 2012, the war for souls with none other than Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Whitley Strieber is the author of many best-selling novels, works of nonfiction as well. Four movies have been made from his books, and more will follow. More recently, the 2004 mega-hit, The Day After Tomorrow, also the latest book, Grays, that's going to be turned into a movie by Sony Pictures. In 1999, he co-produced with Mark Wolper a special for NBC based on his book, Confirmation, and his latest work, which is dear to our hearts, 2012, The War for Souls. And here he is now, Whitley Strieber. Whitley, how are you?
George, it's great to be back. I'm very excited about tonight. We have a lot to talk about.
Oh, my gosh. And this is just coming right down the pike, Whitley. You know, when I started doing Coast to Coast on a regular basis, it was 2003. I mean, here we are now, 2007, soon to be 2008. This is really close now, isn't it?
It's coming straight at us like a freight train. You know, you were mentioning 11-11, the time. And that's the moment of the change. Here's something fascinating. If you add up 12/21/2012, ignoring the zero and adding them up all as single integers, you come out with the number 11. And in numerology, 11 is a very positive number. So hopefully it's going to be a good change.
Well, you know, and I have been, it's been several years now, I've been seeing 11-11, 111 all over the place. Now, I didn't really, until I started to realize that we're talking about 2012 and 11-11 on that date, that's the winter solstice night of December 21st, that night, I didn't realize that had that kind of significance. And I think maybe that's why I've been seeing it. It's leading up to something, and I'm right in it.
Well, it you know, on this program, George, you are in it. You are in the thick of it. All right. The thing is, though, there's no question, really, about the fact that huge change is taking place. The day 2012 itself, I mean, the day of December the 21st, 2012, may or may not mark some very noticeable huge change. We can't know that until and if it happens. However, as we are getting closer and closer to 2012, it's very clear that this world is changing in fundamental ways. And it will never be like it is now. This is really the end of a certain time. What will come in the future, I don't know, but it certainly isn't going to be like this. That is quite clear.
You know what's fascinating too, Whitley? Not only is the planet changing with Earth changes, and it's obvious to all of us when we see it, but people are changing. I mean, I have never witnessed in my life so many people on both ends of the spectrum who are either whacked out, zombies as I call them, or have become so spiritually minded and caring about other people. But they're on both ends, and it's huge numbers.
It is really strange because it's true that there are a very large number of people who just can't seem to face it or kind of ignoring it. And yet there are other people, and I've just been doing a lot of author tours. I was just at a bookstore in San Francisco tonight, and the same thing happened that has been happening everywhere I've been. There is a change in the audience. The people are different. They seem to me to be much more alive. The questions that I'm getting now are far more challenging than they were like 10 years ago. It's really a different kind of ball game, and these people are seriously aware. I mean, these are really powerful people, and people weren't like that before. Absolutely not. I didn't notice. At least they weren't in my audiences.
And they're also short now with people. Tempers seem to flare quicker. It's really weird, Whitley. I don't know what it is, but it's strange.
Well, that I haven't noticed. Of course, I don't get out much. I tend to stay much more at home. My publishers get me out on the road for my books, but I don't tend to. I stay on my website and stay at home writing and working on my movies. I haven't seen too much of that personally, but I have seen a great upsurge in the intensity and the it seems to me people maybe they are could they some of be getting smarter. It used to be when I was had a question and answer session after a book signing or if I was at a lecture or something, I could breeze through it. Now the questions I expect to be challenged, they're hard. They are very hard. These are people who really understand things deeply.
Oh, no, you're right. I see this when I do my speaking engagements. I've got another one coming up in October 20th, 21st in Norfolk, Virginia. You're absolutely right. People in the audience who will ask you a question, not only about the program, for example, or about your books, but, I mean, they are ready to stump you, and you got to be ready for them.
Right. You know, I think Coast has actually played a role in this, in that over the years, this radio program has had so many people on who are out at the edge or beyond it. And the listeners they think carefully, and they have learned to discriminate between the ones that are basically blowing hot air and the others, the ones who may sound incredible, but who actually have something. And there are a lot of those. But they can discriminate, that takes a certain skill, and I think people have developed that skill over the years.
You know, you know Art Bell better than I do. You've worked with him before. You've written a book with him, a bestseller. When he was broadcasting his program on a regular basis out of Pahrump, you know, in his small desert area there, do you think? You know, because I think he's as sharp as a cat. Do you think he realized how huge he was building this, where it touched so many people in so many different ways?
Well, I don't think Art ever thought about that. I think that Art just did his thing. And I think he purposely did not think about that. He just charged on doing it every night. And doing it as best he knew how, and without really thinking about what he was doing, it was part of a huge educational process. The people with the ears to listen were learning, and they were preparing for this change of consciousness. And, you know, like it or not, this program plays an important role in that precisely because it's so open and so free, and it gives people the chance. There's nobody filtering this program. You have all kinds of guests on. Art did too. And that means that people have to either learn to discriminate or they go down a kind of a black hole because they don't know what to think. And they're learning to discriminate. That's what's happening.
Well, and something is continuing to happen, Whitley, because the program has always grown, and it is growing by leaps and bounds on a continuous basis. It always has been, because I sit down with our executives every 3 months when ratings come out, and we're in many markets where a 3 or 4 share of an audience is considered very successful. This program will do 20 shares, 30 shares in some market. It's absolutely unheard of. It is growing because I think exactly as you've said, people's consciousness seems to be growing, and the two seem to be migrating together.
Well, it's certainly things are certainly changing in that respect. And, you know, another area which is fascinating to me is that children are changing. They're so different from the way they were even 10 years ago. They're far more sophisticated and far more conscious of the world around them at ages, very young ages, than they were before. And not only that, there are studies that show that children's IQs have been rising steadily for about 25 years. They're smarter, too.
I think the computer age has pushed that, too, don't you?
Well, I think it's partly that, but I think that IQ is just native intelligence. In other words, I don't think they necessarily that the computer age or anything like that has anything to do with that. I think there's something else going on as well. The species is preparing for it. There's some, on some deep level, the human species knows it's in crisis, and it is putting, as its species, putting its best foot forward. We are responding to the crisis, and, you know, we're going to be here. We're going to have a lot of trouble over the next 25 to 50 years, but we're going to be here in the end. We will be here. We will not. This species isn't going extinct. I can't. That is unbelievable to me. But we're going to be challenged as never before. And so on some deep level, we know it.
Well, in your novels that you write specifically, I've noticed this incredible knack that you have for creating a story, a fascinating story, but around fact. So, I mean, your books are basically nonfiction fiction books because they cross over.
They do, yes. Well, you know, that started with Majestic back in, I think, 1990 or 91, when I did not know much about the Roswell incident. I was vaguely aware of it before I had my close encounter in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1987, I published Communion. And in 1988, my father's brother, my uncle Edward Streber, my uncle Mickey, lovely, wonderful man, called me and said he had something that he would like to talk to me about. Did I know anything about the Roswell incident? And I said, yes, wasn't that UFO that crashed in New Mexico? And he said, yes, it was. He said, well, I know something about it, and I also know somebody who knows a lot more who would like to talk to you. And he had been in Air Force intelligence for his whole career, and so I was fascinated. And he said that he had been at Wright Field when the debris was brought there, and that the debris, that they had attempted to reassemble it and had not been successful. And I was fascinated, and I went and found Bill Moore and Charles Berlitz's book on the Roswell incident, read up on it a little bit. And then he introduced me to General Arthur Exon, who gave one or two brief interviews publicly that sort of confirmed in a smaller way what he said to me. And I talked to him for quite a while, actually, about this. And he started out by saying that everyone from Truman on down knew that what they had found was not of this world within 24 hours of their finding it. And that is an exact quote. He said that he had been liaison between the Air Force and the group that is publicly called Majestic for years, until 1963, in fact, and still periodically went to Wright-Patterson to consult. This was in 1988, I guess, or early 89. And I pieced together from that, from the books I read, from interviews, I went out to Roswell and so forth, a lot of information, but I had no documentation. My uncle wouldn't provide any. General Exon couldn't provide any, he said. And the result was I wrote it all out in a novel because I couldn't prove it. It wasn't. I think Majestic is in large part a book of fact, but I couldn't prove it. So that was the first of those novels. Then years later, I got to a point phenomenon where there was so much that I was fairly sure I was right about, that I was fairly sure I could support, but I couldn't prove.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the genesis of the Grays.
So what you were able to do is take this gut instinct of yours, take some fact that you couldn't prove, and weave it into an amazing story.
Exactly. Like one of the central parts of the Grays, well, there are two of them, two things. One is the relationship between the Grays and children. It's something I lived and something I have so many people have written me about the fact that their children are involved. And I've met quite a few children who were involved. And always I say to the parents the same thing when my child was young. You know, don't talk about it. Don't let them tell you. You know, don't tell them anything. They'll come to you if they need you. And they do. They come to their parents. And they tell their parents these things. So that was a central part of the Grays. But the other part was the interface relationship between a Gray and a human empath. And I don't know if you remember a very strange little piece of video that came from something called Rocket Films years ago. And it was for a few weeks, it was a big thing. I was on CNN or somewhere talking about it, as I recall. And it's a video, just a few seconds, maybe 30, 40 seconds, of a Gray, which is sitting behind a screen. It looks like a glass window, rather. And it gets sick and begins to fall over, and two shadowy figures in medical clothing come up from behind and begin to support it. And in the frame of the video, there's a little green light hopping up and down. And I think it's authentic, this video. And I think that this is a video taken of a situation in which someone who was able to communicate empathically with the Grays was trying to do so. And for whatever reason, it failed. But I used that as it's also based on some things I was told, but I promised to keep them kind of silent, and so I can't really say it directly, but the book has everything I believe to be true about this type of thing that goes on inside the government in its pages as fiction.
What an amazing story. When does the movie come out?
They're getting along with the movie. The director is Wolfgang Petersen, who did, of course, A Perfect Storm and many other fabulous movies.
Right.
The Das Boot. The boat, and as I understand it, they are hoping to get started production in the first quarter of next year. And I don't know when they'll finish, but conceivably, I guess the earliest possible date would be next summer. So it's coming along very definitely.
Well, great. Here we go. And then when we come back from the break in just a moment, Whitley will really dive into 2012, a most fascinating moment, I think, for humanity indeed. What got you to write 2012?
Well, how much time do we have?
Okay. We're not going to have to. We'll have to come back with the sequel portion of your answer.
Right. That's right. Because it's a big answer, and there's a big surprise connected with it, too, believe you me.
Okay, we'll do that. Whitley, of course, has an incredible website called unknowncountry.com, which is the most popular edge science website in the world. And he's also got his own radio station signal out of the internet called Dreamland. So you can get information on that by going to unknowncountry.com. We'll be back in a moment. 2012, The War for Souls with Whitley Strieber. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Our special guest tonight, Whitley Strieber. Whitley, the path that you took towards 2012, how did that start?
Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, I began to notice that a change was accelerating. Art and I wrote Superstorm and published it in 1999. And by 2004, it was obvious that things were unfolding a whole lot faster than we had thought.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Earth changes that we were predicting in 2000 in Superstorm for happening in 2025, 2030, are happening now. And right down to, by the way, in the during the course of the summer, very strong south winds blew over all the way up into the high Arctic and created an ice melt. And that kind of wind blowing up from the south is the sort of thing that brings the energy up necessary to create the kind of great storm that we were predicting in our book. And indeed, during the middle of the summer, a big circulation, it wasn't a storm really, appeared over the Laurentian Sea and over the part of the North Atlantic. It was huge. It dissipated and was gone, but I think that it's possible very soon, one of these days, that we're going to have an extraordinary spring or autumn storm developing in that part of the world. And I don't know what will happen from there, but it would be something like the first hurricane ever to develop in the far North Atlantic. Or not, it would be created in a different way, but it would still be huge. So I began to think to myself, well, you know, these changes are accelerating. And I kept coming back to the idea that around 2011, 2012, it began to look like that would be when we were all certainly aware of the fact that the planet had changed in a fundamental way.
Right.
And then I was amazed last year when I heard that NASA, or some NASA scientists, rather, were predicting that the next solar max would probably be one of the biggest in history based on their analysis of the way that, of the internal workings of the sun. And the solar max is going to be at its height in 2011, 2012. And so I thought, you know, there's just too much going on here.
Yeah.
And I thought I would write about it, and I thought, what do I want to write? I just had an extraordinary experience writing The Grays, because it took me to places, the writing took me to places that I couldn't go with nonfiction, places where I know that there is truth, but which I can't assert as fact. And I started trying to do the same thing with 2012. I didn't really know what would come of it when I started writing, and I really never do when I write a book. I just get this feeling about it, and then I start writing, and it kind of forms itself. And all of a sudden, I find myself dealing with parallel universes. I thought, what are you doing? And that developed more and more until finally I found myself writing a book about a novelist who is writing a book about two parallel universes. And as time passes and it gets closer and closer to December the 21st, 2012, gateways begin to open, and they happen to open in this poor guy's backyard because he's in our universe, in the middle of the three parallel universes. We're the middle universe. And he's right near the geographic center of the United States, living in Kansas. And he realizes in the course of the story that he's not writing a novel. He's writing a history. It's really happening.
Yeah.
And here's the mind bender. The day the book was published, I opened the New Scientist magazine, and I've just written a book about a novelist who's writing about parallel universes, who's discovering that it's all real. And I read this. This is actually not from the New Scientist. It's a news story from Breitbart. And it said this: parallel universes really do exist. According to a mathematical discovery by Oxford scientists, described by one expert as, quote, one of the most important developments in the history of science. That came out literally on the day the book was published. And then I thought, wait a minute. I'm a novelist writing a novel, just published a novel, about a novelist who was writing a novel about parallel universes, who discovered in the book that they were real. And on the day I published the book, it was announced that they actually are real. It blew my mind. I couldn't believe it.
These things just don't happen, Whitley. You know that.
Oh, we were talking, George, a little bit earlier about your 11-11 synchronicities.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff is happening everywhere. And here it is in my life, with the publication of this book.
Well, and the story that you weave is very possible, and that's what makes it fascinating.
Well, before this work was published, I wouldn't have said it was very possible. I would have said, yeah, parallel universes might exist, but apparently the math is really strong, and it's suggesting that they do exist. The New Scientist is a very prestigious publication, and they don't speculate lightly in there. These are very highly educated, credible people. And I will add that there still remains controversy about it. There's another important scientist who feels like he can solve the whole question without resorting to parallel universes. But basically, the math is really strong. So, yes, they might be real. But here's the most bizarre part. If there are parallel universes, if the many worlds theory is true, then it's probable that the parallel universes in my book are real. They're really here, right around us. And does this mean that we will experience some kind of extraordinary opening of gateways as 2012 comes closer? I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know one thing. A whole lot of us are going to find out.
The question, too, Whitley, is what did the Mayans know, and how did they know it?
Boy, isn't that a good question.
Yeah.
That is a mystery wrapped in an enigma, because the concept of a galaxy is a 20th century discovery. The discovery of galaxies is so new, and yet the Maya were acting and functioning in their astronomy as if they knew what galaxies, not only galaxies were, but there are implications in the Popol Vuh that they may have known what a black hole was. And where did that come from? And George, you have to ask the question, what are we? And what is our real past? Where do we come from? And what did these people know? They are a lot like, in this respect, like the ancient Egyptians. If you look at ancient Egyptian religion with its elaborate rituals that are all designed to seem to have some sort of hidden meaning, they are like the rituals evolved by a cargo cult, like in New Guinea during World War II, when the natives, who had never seen anything like an airplane in their lives, saw these planes coming into land and open the doors and bring riches out, all kinds of beautiful things. They began to build airfields, and they built planes out of bamboo and leaves and tried to lure the passing Air Force airplanes into landing there. They would go so far as to build bamboo refrigerators and to move back and forth between the airplane and the refrigerator, making noises that sounded to them like English, and then open the bamboo refrigerator and hope that beer and meat and stuff came out. And the Egyptian religion, with its strange ritualized practices, and the Mayan religion the same way, they have that look. They have the look of a cargo cult, of something being done by people who were once perhaps in possession, or it could observe, a great science, but who have either forgotten it or it has left and gone away, leaving them behind to try to duplicate its powers without actually knowing how to do that.
Oh, see, and I think you're right. I think it left and it went away. You know, if someone today would come on in here and start building a submarine, which I wouldn't know the first thing about building one, even though I was in the Navy for 9 years, I could make one, and then picked up his plans and left, I might be able to tell the story about it, but I surely couldn't build it.
Exactly.
And it might be the same thing with the Mayans. Somebody somewhere may have given them mathematical formulas, dates, predictions of the future, but when they decided to up and leave, they left them with nothing.
They did leave them with one thing. They left them with a powerful mathematics and a powerful understanding of astronomy, because the ability to calculate out the solstices for that long in the future was completely foreign to every other culture at that time in the world. No one else could have done it.
If you had to equate their knowledge, the Mayans' knowledge of their era, with our knowledge today, what year do you think, with that compatible knowledge, what year do you think we'd be at today if we had the Mayans' knowledge based on their year? Would we be at the year 2500, 3000? How far advanced were these people?
Well, I'm not absolutely sure I can answer that question, because they were primitive in some respects, and after all, they weren't advanced enough to have saved themselves, because something happened there. There are still a lot of Maya in the Yucatan, but they are not practicing and living that culture anymore, and it wasn't the Spaniards coming that changed things. The culture collapsed long before the Spaniards came, for reasons that we don't fully understand, and it's such a strange thing. I have a friend called Richardson Gill, who is a scholar of the Mayan. He spent a lot of time trying to prove that it was drought that did it, and he may be right, but there's also signs of violence, and some of the cities are simply abandoned, as if they just quit. They realized at some point that all of their rituals were not working, and they quit. That's almost what it looks like.
Or disappeared.
Or disappeared, yes, like the Anasazi in the American Southwest, who just disappeared. But, you know, looking back at the past, one of the things that we don't understand about this Earth and this place that we live is that it's a violent, a place of intense, powerful, and sudden change. Recently at the IEEE meeting in Acapulco, a couple of scientists who've also published a book and written some papers about this published an absolutely marvelous paper about a catastrophe that occurred here back about 15,000 years ago. And this catastrophe involved something striking what was then called the Laurentian Ice Sheet above what is now the Great Lakes. This impact is not very well documented because it hit ice, and, you know, ice melts, so there's no crater. But although they think that the crater may be the Great Lakes. In any case, this thing sent icebergs flying through the air, mountains of ice, so with such power that some of them struck in New Mexico and all through the Carolinas, and it instantly vaporized a part of that glacier the size of Rhode Island. The whole glacier over the next few months and years collapsed, melted, large parts of it went sliding down the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. Sea levels rose 20 or 30 feet worldwide as the massive ice sheets collapsed, and there was a flood in the eastern half of the United States. United States that left something called that is now called the Black Mat. And you find this when you dig down over very, very large areas of this country. And what it is dead algae, because the melting glacier happened so fast and was so intense that if you can imagine the scale of this, the entire continent was flooded. And as the floodwaters went down, and if you can think that from Atlanta to Denver, a flood, it's unimaginable. As the floodwaters went down, the algae that had formed on the top of them ended up on dry land and died. And when archaeologists in the Americas are digging down and they reach the Black Mat, they know they have reached the so-called Clovis layer, that below it there will be one type of arrowhead from one people, and then above it a completely new type of arrowhead from a completely different people. That is the scale of it. Now, if there was a culture in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Caribbean at the time, their sea coasts would have been hundreds of miles from where the coasts are now.
Right.
We want to find this great culture. We need to find those sea coasts and do some underwater archaeology. Very little has been done. There was some indication of a possible finding of a city off the coast of Cuba by a French-Canadian research team. This with sonars, and this never went anywhere. It never went farther than that. It was almost, I don't know what happened to the story. But somewhere down there, the answer to this mystery, I suspect, exists.
Whitley, these parallel universes that you write about in 2012, we'll get into that in just a second. But the subtitle of the book is called The War for Souls. That's very important to this whole scope of this book, isn't it?
Yes, it's very important, because I think that's what this experience that we have is about. And the reason I think that is quite simple. First, I believe we have a soul. I was doubtful. Before I had my close encounter experience, you could have counted me as a member of PsyCop, a skeptic. I was not into this.
Michael Shermer would have loved you then, huh?
And Phil Kless. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, stay with us, Whitley. I want to get into that story when we come back, because the book, of course, is called 2012, but right underneath it, it says The War for Souls. I'm George Norrie, back with Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast AM.